Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page.
And I'm trying to make amends in the best way that I can. I mean, I grew up in, I should explain, Charlie, I grew up in South London.
Right.
I can't remember any anti-Semitic taunts, but I do remember other racial taunts. First wave of immigrants, a melting pot of cultures. And I would have heard those kind of taunts. I was still very, very sick. I mean, when you see that video, I'm in the throes of my disease.
Fashion designer John Galliano talking to Charlie Rose 2 years ago. It was his first TV interview after he ruined his career with a drunk anti-Semitic tirade that was captured on video and went viral. Coming up, I'll chat with the author of a new book about the rise and fall of Galliano and his fellow designer, Alexander McQueen. But first, cholesterol. It's bad for you, right? Well, for decades, Americans have been told to avoid it. That's about to change. Now the federal government is expected to drop cholesterol warnings from the country's official nutrition guidelines. So what does that mean for your egg consumption? And can you now eat as many pastrami sandwiches as your greasy heart desires? Peter Woriski is a reporter for The Washington Post. He's been covering this story. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, this isn't official yet, but a panel called the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee is expected to recommend the change. How big a deal is this?
It's a pretty big deal if you've grown up hearing forever and ever that cholesterol is a dangerous substance and we really need to be worried about it. As you know, the cholesterol is something that they mark out on a nutrition label, and they've been warning for quite a while that we should keep our intake below 300 milligrams a day.
Right. And so it's kind of confusing because our body makes cholesterol, and then there's also dietary cholesterol, which is what we're talking about it. There's saturated fat and unsaturated fat, good fat, bad fat. It's all tied in together. So explain exactly what dietary cholesterol does or doesn't do to our bodies.
Well, this is, you're right, it's very confusing. This warning has nothing to do with the, or very little to do with the cholesterol in your blood. If you have high, bad cholesterol levels, it's still bad for you. What this panel is basically saying is that the focus on cholesterol can be dropped now, on cholesterol that you eat, because cholesterol that you eat for most healthy people has very little to do with your cholesterol levels in your blood.
So what causes the cholesterol levels in your blood?
That would be, first of all, it's a natural thing. We create more cholesterol than we consume. And one of the things that boosts our production of cholesterol in the blood are things like saturated fats and trans fats.
But doesn't dietary cholesterol oftentimes walk hand in hand with saturated fats and trans fats?
It can, and certainly there are things that we all eat that carry both. But this is sort of the focus on cholesterol has given things like shrimp and have been a knock against shrimp and a knock against eggs and a knock against lobster, which don't have very much saturated fat, but do have significant amounts of cholesterol.
So I know that not all nutritionists agree with this. How controversial is this change?
Well, here's the thing. This is the thing that I keep going back to. I talked to the American Heart Association a couple years ago, got a bunch of their best experts together and said, so how seriously should somebody be worried about cholesterol? Is there a connection between a cholesterol-heavy diet and heart disease? And their finding was, no, we don't see evidence yet. At the same time, I called up the guy who's the head of that study, and he's still eating his omelets without the egg yolks, which are the cholesterol-rich part of an egg. because he still is kind of worried about cholesterol. So even though he couldn't find any evidence that it was causing heart disease, he wasn't ready to start consuming a whole bunch more.
Okay, so, but they're still saying bad cholesterol is bad for you. Is bad cholesterol linked to heart disease?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the stuff that's in your, the bad cholesterol is the kind that's in your blood. It's a low-density lipoproteins. That's what, when you get the, those two numbers, is the HDL and the LDL when you go to the doctor. The bad cholesterol is the LDL, is reflected in the LDL number. And that is still linked to heart disease for by most people.
And again, that is something that is caused by consuming too much saturated fat.
Yes. Saturated fats has a much greater effect on your bad cholesterol level than actually eating cholesterol.
So we can't go out and eat a bunch of, I don't know, donuts, hamburgers, ice cream?
No. Well, you can, and I probably will, but that's because I ignore most of the advice I get on my diet.
All right. So these warnings of cholesterol, as we say, they go way back, maybe half a century. Tell us about the research on rabbits in the early 1900s that paved the way for this.
Right. That was way, way back at the Tsar's Medical Institute in St. Petersburg, Russia. They knew at that time that this waxy substance, cholesterol, was clogging people's arteries, and they could... they decided to start testing it in rabbits, giving them high levels of cholesterol. And what they found was that it really got to them. It killed them, or, you know, really clogged their arteries quite quickly. And so that was sort of the very beginnings of this campaign against dietary cholesterol. The research trail kind of doesn't go forward very much, but then in the 30s and 40s, heart disease starts going up in the United States, and they start looking at it more and more. And that's where the scientists really began to think, look, cholesterol is the bad guy.
Okay, and then egg farmers took a big hit because everyone stopped eating eggs. Do you think that lobbying played a role in this change that we're seeing today?
You know, they definitely, the egg, it's called the American Egg Board, and they're the main lobbying group for the egg people. They do spend some money on research, and I'm sure they do some lobbying, but they've been lobbying for a long time, and nothing's happened. I mean, this started, the first time the federal government picked up this warning was officially, as far as I can tell, this was 1977. So if they were lobbying against this, they were unsuccessful for almost 40 years. I think this has less to do with their lobbying than sort of a change in philosophy about food and how we should warn people about it. It has to do with, you know, as one of the scientists told me, look, we just got to stop thinking of eggs as cholesterol capsules. They actually have positive qualities that, you know, should be taken into account, but they weren't because everybody's, they're cholesterol bombs.
Peter Wariski, reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
The reemergence of measles has created a dilemma for pediatricians. What to do about parents who refuse to have their children vaccinated? Do you continue to treat the unvaccinated kids, potentially putting other children in the office and elsewhere at risk? Or do you reject unvaccinated patients and give up the possibility to support that kid's health and to educate and work with the parents? Well, joining me now are two doctors who agree on the need for all children to be vaccinated, but they've come to different conclusions about whether to treat unvaccinated patients. Eric Ball is a pediatrician in Orange County. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Madeline.
And Leila Bozorgnia is a pediatrician in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Hi there. Thank you.
Let's start with you, Dr. Ball. You're in Orange County, and this really has been ground zero for this latest measles outbreak. Has your practice seen a lot of unvaccinated kids?
We do. We're kind of at the epicenter for unvaccinated patients, and we've had several cases of measles in our practice, not just in this current episode, but also we had a reasonably large outbreak last year.
Wow. And so what do you do? How do you handle that?
So it's been difficult, and our practice has been in business for almost 40 years, and we've always accepted unvaccinated patients and tried to work as much as possible with parents to convince them to vaccinate, but we've never turned away patients in the past, largely because this has been somewhat theoretical over the past 10 to 15 years. We haven't seen measles very much, but with the reemergence of these diseases, particularly in our community, we're now getting a lot of pressure from our community and our parents of vaccinated patients to really take a stronger stand to make sure that we can try to increase the vaccination rate.
So what have you done to do that? How have you changed your policy?
So we have decided, and this actually stems from an exposure from measles in our waiting room last year, where several babies were exposed to an unvaccinated 2-year-old with measles who came into our office. We have decided that we are no longer going to see patients who choose to not vaccinate at all. So we're not going to take new patients who don't vaccinate. And our existing patients who are under-immunized, and I'd estimate that's probably 15 to 20% of our patient population, we are encouraging them to make appointments with the doctor to formulate a plan to catch their children up in an adequate way.
So do you have patients who are not vaccinated and you had to break the news to their parents?
We do. We do.
And what are those conversations like?
It's hard. I've had families who I've been taking care of their kids for almost a decade and, kind of passively supporting them. And I've had conversations with them numerous times a year about vaccination. And so they know how I feel about the situation. And they have elected to see another doctor because their beliefs about false beliefs about vaccines supersede our doctor-patient relationship. And that's been really tough because I have close relationships with these children.
Let's bring in Dr. Bozorgnia now. You are on the West Side, also probably an area of the city where there are a fair amount of parents who decide to delay or forego vaccinations. Have you had a similar situation?
No, I have not, but I think that also may in due part be because we're a newer practice. We've been around for about 2.5 years. Most of my prospective patients have a meet and greet with me before they choose to come to us or a prenatal visit. And often during that visit, I make it quite clear that I believe in vaccinations and the benefits of vaccines, and I follow the standard schedule and don't advocate for alternative schedules. And so what I find is I think that sets things up so that the patients that choose me tend to be patients who believe in vaccines also, and we have kind of that the same train of thought. In the past, I have had maybe 1 to 2 families who still chose to come with us but did not vaccinate their children, and they eventually switched practices because I try to bring it up at every appointment. And so I think, it's just something that's constantly reiterated, and eventually those parents have such different views that they end up choosing a different pediatrician.
But what would you say if a parent said to you, I just don't feel comfortable vaccinating my child with the MMR vaccine and I don't want to do it, but I want to stay with you and keep you as my doctor? What would you then say to that parent?
Well, I offer them reading material from the AAP, the CDC, and just ask them to read over the material and then try to address their concerns and their fears. Often the parents bring up the possibility of whether there's an association with autism. So we talk about how there's no association with autism, and I try to bring up the fact that I also vaccinate my son on the standard schedule and just try to relate to them and assuage their fears.
But what if you were faced with a situation that Dr. Ball just described? Would you, in fact, forbid them from being in your practice, or would you keep seeing them and try to persuade them?
So, in training, we were taught to try to use every opportunity we have to try to provide education and resources for parents to encourage them to vaccinate their children. So I'd like to say that, yes, I hope that I can continue on that same path, but I understand it must have been a very hair-raising experience for Dr. Gall to have that experience in his office.
Right, because babies cannot be vaccinated before they're 1 year old, right, for the MMR?
Right.
So they are
right.
At risk. And Dr. Ball, are you afraid that you are giving up an opportunity by letting these patients go, these parents go, to educate them and change their minds?
You know, it's been interesting because I think that over the past few weeks, once we made this public, I've had so many patients coming in who had were unvaccinated or undervaccinated, and they're catching their kids up. I've had some new patients who are coming to our practice specifically because they're going to feel safer in our waiting room than they might in another practice. So it's been interesting that I think that actually we are putting out there that we feel so strongly about this that we feel that every kid needs to be vaccinated fully, that the opposite reaction to what we thought might happen is happening. We're having a ton of positive feedback from our families. And then again, we're having lots of patients who didn't vaccinate. I've had 6-, 7-, 8-year-olds who have never had an MMR vaccine come in and get it over the past week. And part of that is because the diseases are more real now. They're seeing measles in the community. And part of it is because we have a trusting relationship and they don't want to lose that relationship. And they're really responding to it.
But the American Academy of Pediatrics does not recommend rejecting non-vaccinated patients.
That's true.
And so is this something that you and your colleagues have really struggled with? Is this an ongoing conversation?
We've struggled with it tremendously. And there are other practices in our community that also do not take unvaccinated patients. Some do, and we're happy that there's other places for these people to go. But we struggled with it, and we came to the determination that it's our role as pediatricians not only to take care of an individual child, but we also have to be thinking about all the other kids in our practice and all the other kids in the community. And we feel that if we are accepting the fact that parents are not vaccinating their kids, particularly those who do no vaccinations at all, we're giving them tacit approval that that's okay. And in the end, like, that's not okay. And we have to take a stand for that. And that was very difficult for us to do. And again, we're going to lose some patients we've had for a very long time. But we need to put it out there very firmly that vaccines are safe, they're effective, and they've been saving lives.
There are some doctors, though, who have said, look, it should be up to the parents to decide whether or not their child should be vaccinated. What do you think? I mean, do you think that's the right thing? Do you think it should be ultimately in the parents' hands? Or do you think that these vaccines should ultimately be required in the interests of public health?
In the end, this is the parents' decision. Like, we're not going to force parents to vaccinate their kids. This is a free country. On the other hand, my patients who have cancer and my patients who have heart transplants, my patients who are immunosuppressed, like, they also have the right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness and not to get measles when they're in my waiting room and not to get whooping cough when they're at school. So, yes, parents have absolutely the right to treat their children how they choose, but we as a pediatric practice, we also have the right to not treat patients who are not going to vaccinate. So we have to take a stand against that.
And Dr. Bazorgnia, do you think that parents in the wealthier areas, the west side of LA, Orange County, why do you think it is that they have such a high rate of unvaccinated children?
I think social media has a lot to do with it. I think social blogging has a big part in it. A few times I've gone on these social blogs myself, and it's enough to give you heart palpitations to see the kind of misinformation that's on these websites and blogs. So I think it's really important to make sure that our patients are going to trusted websites that have good information and true information. I try to direct them to, like, the CDC website and the AAP websites and healthychildren.org.
The law in California says that if you want to send your kid to school and you don't want to have them vaccinated, you need to get a personal belief exemption signed by a doctor. Would you ever sign that?
Yes, I have signed personal belief exemptions. I do have a small percentage of patients, maybe about 15%, who are under-immunized, so they are kind of slowing down their rate of vaccine.
Have you considered not doing that anymore?
No, I haven't. Again, you know, I think the key is, as a physician, I try to do my due diligence in bringing it up at every visit when I see the parents come in for a well-care visit, to try to get those kids vaccinated. And again, it's a small percentage of my practice, and I don't have any non-vaccinating parents.
Undervaccinated, though, don't they pose also a risk to the greater community?
Yes, absolutely. But I'd rather at least have that kid vaccinated than to turn them away and have them go somewhere where they may actually go to a practice that may not be vaccinating or not be encouraging vaccination.
And Dr. Ball, I assume you would not sign that exemption?
So I used to sign a lot of them. My name is on a lot of exemptions. But as of now, if you're unvaccinated, we obviously won't sign those anymore. Now, we have a lot of patients who were undervaccinated who have changed their mind and are going to catch up. And the catching up process takes a long time, months to years. So we're happy to sign those for people who are actively in the process of getting caught up. But we'll be signing a lot fewer of them than we did in the past.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking time out of your very busy schedules to talk to us today.
Thanks, Mal.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Dr. Leila Bazorgnia, pediatrician in Los Angeles, and Dr. Eric Ball, a pediatrician in Orange County. Coming up, why Cubans have enjoyed preferential treatment as immigrants and why that may change next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The thawing of relations with Cuba has sparked a new conversation about immigration policy here in the U.S., specifically whether to throw out the law that favors Cuban immigrants over other immigrants. The 1966 law is called the Cuban Adjustment Act. It says that any Cuban, once they arrive in the United States, can become a permanent resident after a year and a U.S. citizen after five. Now, lawmakers in Washington, particularly Republicans from Florida, are pushing for a new look at that law. Guillermo Grenier is a professor of sociology at Florida International University, and he joins us from Miami. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, a lot of these lawmakers are Cubans themselves, or Cuban Americans, Republican Senator Marco Rubio for one. And I mean, at first glance, you would think that they would be in favor of this law, but they're pushing to revise it?
They're pushing to revise it because this is one of these situations where both the right and the left kind of have something in common. The right right now, led by Rubio, and a lot of the old guard Cuban exiles, the ones that have come in the earlier waves, Cuban immigration to the United States has been pretty constant since 1959, right after the revolution. And it's had its little spigots that have been turned on and off, but it's been pretty regularly occurring phenomenon. And so now what they're saying is that the new arrivals are different than the first few waves. They're not exiles. They're not leaving a repressive government. They're coming for other reasons. And the proof of that is that when they get here, they turn right around as soon as they can and go back with laden with goods from the U.S. to help their families and friends on the island, which didn't come with them. So they're making a statement that at this point in time, the law is not fulfilling its what it was intended to do, and which, by the way, the Cuban government has been saying for a long, long time, and that's where the left comes in on the same point in saying that, in essence, this law has been assuming that all immigrants from Cuba have left because of political reasons, and the Cuban government and others, even here in Miami, have been saying for a long time, no, that's not the case. These are economic migrants that have other reasons for coming rather than purely political or exile reasons, as was initially proposed by the law as a way to receive them.
Help me understand this from a political point of view, though, because I would think that if you are a Cuban-American politician, or even if you are an entrenched powerful Cuban-American who has business interests in Florida, let's say, that you would want more Cubans to come to the United States and be granted citizenship because that just increases the power of the Cuban-American community.
Well, that's assuming that the Cuban-American community has one voice and that that voice is represented by those that are in opposition to or have a hard line towards the Cuban government, and that's simply not the case. It's been changing over the years. And furthermore, I think that politicians like Rubio and several others who have been elected in this region, in this area, really have to read the tea leaves and see and kind of put their finger up to the wind, because the fact is the Cuban-American community has changed. And the new arrivals are nothing like the old arrivals. They don't support the policies that Rubio and others are advancing in Washington, that is, of a stricter maintaining of regulations that were put into place, like the embargo 50 years ago. The new arrivals are not of that ink at all. They want to maintain a transnational relationship with the island. They have relatives there. They have family there. They've lived a life there, as opposed to the 60s and 70s exiles that have not lived a life there. And they are the ones, actually, in the long run, that are going to be most beneficial to the transitions that are going on the island, because they know the turf over there, and they are becoming more proficient in working the U.S. system. So the new arrivals, if they keep coming, they will vote out Rubios and others that have been elected to maintain and implement harsh, or I would say inflexible, views of what the island is like.
And meanwhile, there are other immigrants in Florida from Latin America who may be fleeing harsher regimes, people from, let's say, El Salvador, Guatemala, uh-huh. Honduras.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that if you give the same definition, or the same, if you want to describe the Cuban government as being authoritarian and perhaps not giving equal rights to all the individuals in the country, and for that reason we should encourage migration from them, from that country, because that will allow us to weaken that authoritarian regime and at the same time paint ourselves as welcoming this kind of folks that are under these kinds of conditions. You could apply that to so many countries around not only around the world, but around Latin America, that the immigrants or the folks fleeing those conditions are not getting the slip and slide into citizenship that the Cubans get. So it is a real issue. What you have now is Cuba is now a national issue, and he has made decisions on Cuba in the national interest. So once you get Cuba being spoken of as a national concern as opposed to a concern of the area code 305 down here, then you have a national reason to look at Cuban immigration. And if you want to normalize that immigration, you have to look at it as a national, as being woven into the national concern over immigration.
Although the White House says it has no plans to try to repeal that act or get it repealed.
Right, right. Never say never. I think it's going to have to be changed. And I don't know how. I don't have my crystal ball with me. But last year, when the Cuban government changed its exit policies, which made it a lot easier for Cuban residents, Cuban citizens, to leave the country without incredible bureaucratic obstacles. Obstacles now are smaller. They're kind of like speed bumps. Once that was done, meaning that Cubans can leave that island a lot easier. And in the last poll that we did in 2014, we saw that people are getting more and more visitors from the island after the Cuban government reduced its exit requirements. Because of that, I think the U.S. is going to see this, an uptick in already record-setting decade of migration from Cuba. So I think that the law would have been looked at anyway, my sense is. But how exactly it's going to be jiggied with, I'm not at all certain.
Well, it's been reported that people in Cuba are worried that this is going to be repealed, and they're coming over. They're taking to their boats.
That's right.
In their rafts.
That's right. They're certain that now normalization means exactly that. The U.S. is going to start looking, maybe slowly, maybe not overnight, but it's going to be looking at the process of normalizing relationships with Cuba. Any normalization process will include examining how Cubans end up being admitted and integrated into U.S. society. So they're concerned that actually they're kind of overestimating how quickly the U.S. government works in that regard. But I think that they're considering the possibility that this law, this beneficial law for them, will be changed. So they are jumping in the water. The incidents, the Coast Guard reports that more Cubans now have been interceded in the Florida Straits than for the last decade. So I think that you have people jumping in thinking that this is close to changing, and they want to make it under that closing door.
Mm. So there is still this wet foot, dry foot policy, which seems a little strange, where if you're caught on water by the Coast Guard, you're sent back to Cuba. But as soon as you touch the dry ground, you're in.
Yep, that's it. And it's a contested law, to say the least, because you have incidences, for example, about 10 years ago, you had incidences where you had Cubans that were almost on land. I mean, they were walking. They were walking on the sand, and the Coast Guard is pushing them back with water cannons and pepper sprays, and then taking them when they're still wet and then repatriating them. And there was a famous case in 2006 where some Cubans had the bad luck of arriving in the Florida Keys in an area that's not connected to the rest of the continent, on this old bridge that ceased functioning. It didn't go anywhere. It's a bridge to nowhere. But they were stranded there, so technically they were not on land, so they were repatriated. So yes, it's a very odd twist, and I think that historically the reason it was put into effect here is because in 1994 you had a mass exodus from Cuba. You had about 34,000 people jumping in boats and rafts, rubber duckies, anything that would float, getting out of there. So then Clinton, instead of saying, okay, come on in, instead he said, wait. I said, I'm not going to play that game. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take these 34,000 people, I'm going to put them in a safe haven, ended up being Guantanamo, and then I'm going to hammer out an agreement with Cuba to prevent this from happening again. So the agreement that they came up with is that Cubans will discourage that kind of exit, and the United States will discourage that kind of entrance by saying that the Coast Guard will not automatically bring them in, which was the case before 1995, automatically bring them into the United States. And instead of that, if you're found in the water, the agreement said, you know, we'd send you back to Cuba, and the Cubans agreed to take them without any negative consequences to the unfortunate traveler.
So we've been talking to you as an academic who studies this issue, but you also have a personal story. You were born in Havana. Did you benefit from this 1966 law?
Oh, absolutely. I benefited. My family benefited. We arrived in the early 60s, and we Cubans, the ones that came early, came in under special parolee refugee status. That is not a permanent status legally here, so our status had to be adjusted after a certain point when it was obvious that we were not going anywhere, that we were establishing Little Havana over here, and we liked our home away from home. So, yes, I benefited from it greatly. And when you look at Miami, when you come to Miami and you see the incredible presence of Cubans here, and you look around and you say, man, this Cuban Adjustment Act really helped this region develop. And you can't argue with that.
Guillermo Grenier, expert in Cuban immigration and a professor of sociology at Florida International University in Miami. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Welcome, welcome to The Daily Show. Craig Kilborn is on assignment in Kuala Lumpur. I'm Jon Stewart. Coming up on today's show, Stephen Colbert with the latest analysis out of Washington. Beth Littleford interviews the original Munchkins. And Michael J. Fox is my first guest, and he's a nice man for doing it. But first, let the healing begin. It's headlines.
Well, the headline today, of course, is that after that first Daily Show 15 years ago, Jon Stewart is stepping down as host.
I don't think I'm going to miss being on television every day. I'm going to miss coming here every day. I love the people here. They're the best. They're creative and collaborative and kind, and that's alliterative, but it's cheating because it's a K. But you understand what I'm saying. I love them and respect them so much.
We love you, Jon!
Yeah!
What is this fluid? What are these feelings?
Jon Stewart last night. Well, we'd like to hear from you about whom you think should replace Jon Stewart. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or Twitter at KCRW PressPlay. Coming up on the show, the glorious and tragic careers of fashion designers John Galliano and Alexander McQueen, how they embodied the global fashion industry, which ultimately destroyed them. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, 4 years ago, the fashion designer John Galliano sabotaged his career. He unleashed a drunken anti-Semitic rant at a Paris cafe, and it was captured on video and went viral.
Are you blonde with blue? No, but
I love Hitler. See, people like you would be dead today. Your mothers, your forefathers would be gassed.
Oh my God. We have a problem.
With you, yeah, I'm not with
all people.
So that wasn't the first time that he had made anti-Semitic remarks. Days later, Galliano was fired as chief designer for Christian Dior. He'd spent the last 15 years reinventing that storied fashion house. Well, a year before Galliano's implosion, another fashion prodigy also self-destructed, Alexander McQueen, who turned clothing design into fine art, killed himself, and he was just 40 years old. Galliano and McQueen's influence went beyond clothes. They helped open the exclusive world of high fashion to the masses, turned it into big business, and became celebrities in the process. Ultimately, though, they could not withstand the pressure. A new book out this week tells the story of these two men and how their lives were remarkably similar. Dana Thomas is the author of Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, for those of us who aren't familiar with high fashion, can you describe their styles? What did their clothes look like?
Well, as Alexander McQueen himself once said, John Galliano was the romantic and McQueen was the realist. John loved to do clothes that were based on beautiful periods of history. He romanticized and fantasized about the French Revolution, the French Empire of Napoleon, the 1920s in Paris, the 1930s in Paris, the Edwardian period in London. And he took these clothes and made them new again through using modern fabrics and modern techniques and just adapting them to our modern lives. McQueen, on the other hand, began his career in London on Savile Row as a tailor. And so for him, you needed to be well-dressed and your clothes should fit you beautifully and be made for you, if you could, of the finest materials and a very sharp and classic line.
Although his most famous collections were outrageous. I mean, he would use lots of feathers, and I remember in particular those shoes that looked like lobster claws.
Yes, he did. What he liked to do was he used shows and he used fashion as a way to put forth his social commentary on life and society today. And so that last show with the lobster claw, in fact, was about Darwin and about survival of the fittest and the beauty of nature.
Both men had very similar backgrounds, as you write. Both were shy growing up. They were gay. They were bullied, raised in tough London neighborhoods. McQueen was 10 years younger, so he presumably, as a fashion student, knew all about John Galliano because he often referenced his work.
Yes, Galliano loomed large in McQueen's life. I felt as I continued to write and study and research about them and talk to all their friends, I talked to more than 150 new people for the book, as well as relied on 30 years of notes, press kits, clippings, things I found down in my basement that I'd long forgotten about. One thing that kept coming up again and again was that Galliano never really paid attention deeply or worried greatly about what his competitors were doing. He did his own thing. He was like a racehorse with blinders on. He was running his own race. McQueen, on the other hand, being 10 years younger and starting 5 to 10 years after Galliano, but sure that he was better than Galliano, would say often, I will outdo him and I will beat him and I will be better than him and he is the place we need to reach for and I will surpass it. McQueen was a bit jealous. But McQueen also was so sure of his talent that he knew that he could do what John did and many other people and do it better, technically better. There was a wonderful tale of an intern working with him, and he asked the student, what are you all studying in school right now? And the student said, we're learning about how Balenciaga did this incredible dress with only one seam that you could not see, and how what a feat of engineering it was and how impossible, and no one's ever been able to do it since. And the next morning, the student walked into the studio, and there was exactly a replica of what Balenciaga had done, and McQueen whipped it off overnight by himself in the studio without having the lessons of how to do it.
So Alexander McQueen he's in his 20s when he's appointed head of a storied fashion house, Givenchy, in Paris. And, at the same time, John Galliano is the head of Christian Dior, both owned by LVMH. So they're both in the same company. And they're both these working class Brits who are now overthrowing French fashion. That's quite a phenomenon.
Yes, it was. And it caused quite a stir in the French press at the time. I remember reading the Figaro in Le Monde. It was just a scandal. Taxi drivers talked about it. Everyone was shocked.
So both of them, this is in the 90s, Galliano and McQueen, they're on the up and up. They're running these storied fashion houses. They're the stars of fashion. And at the same time, though, the pressure is enormous.
Yes. Every year that would pass, a couple more collections would be added because they were being such a great success. There was ways to spin it off and make more, do more. So suddenly there was lingerie, and then there was fur, and then there was bathing suits, and there was children's lines, and then there was menswear, and then there were shoes, and there were they just kept getting more piled onto them. And by the end, John Galliano at Dior was overseeing 32 collections a year.
Along with all this pressure and all this decadence and all this money, they both become big drug and alcohol users.
Yes. What happened was they were artists, and artists, generally speaking, are more sensitive than the number-crunching accountants who are just looking at bottom lines and saying this doesn't add up. And they would have to make compromises that were really soul-crushing. So they started self-medicating. At the same time, they were also artists who liked making things. By the end, they were managers, and they were telling teams of people, I want you to do something with this, and let's try doing something about the Queen or about India or about let's do, and they would come up with ideas. They were idea guys, but they weren't making things anymore except decisions. So they were sad, they were overworked, they were depressed, they were anxious. They were taking meds for anxiety. They were self-medicating through drugs and drink. It was a mess. And McQueen did seek out help, but then he never had time to go because he was too busy at the office. Mm.
So he only saw one way out?
Well, he was trying to get out. He was always coming up with escape plans. And finally, he had come up with a really good solution, which was to go and teach in San Francisco with his friend Simon Unglis. And Simon was working at the Academy of Art in San Francisco. And he said, what if I come out there and start the master's program with you in fashion and I teach? And then I just go back once in a while to London to work on two collections a year to keep my hand in it. And the school was happy about it and he was happy. And then there was always another collection to do. There was always another deadline to meet. And he just couldn't get out. And because of his drug addiction, paranoia was acute. His anxiety was overtaking him. His mother was dying and then did die of cancer. Some people said at the time that he killed himself, it was because he was depressed about his mother dying. But one friend of his told me he killed himself after his mother died because he didn't ever want to do it while his mother was alive. It would be too upsetting for her. But now that she was gone, he felt that he had permission to, and so he took it. Mm.
And then John Galliano also self-destructs, not literally, but he ruined his career, his reputation, with his very public anti-Semitic rants. And I'm wondering if that was him also trying to escape and get out of it.
I think it was. And he says now that he's not thankful, but he's aware that had these videos not surfaced and he had not been arrested and he had not been fired, he has said that, if he'd been on that path another 6 months, he too would have died because of his combination of prescription drugs with alcohol and the pace that he was personally keeping, not simply because of work, but that he was running and that he was spiraling downward and it had a dark ending. So while he's, of course, not happy to have lost his job, he is happy, I believe, from what I understand, that he's been given a second chance and that he can go on, unlike McQueen.
He's working for another fashion house?
He is working for another fashion house. He's been sober for 4 years. He's doing some gardening at his country house, and apparently the gardens are gorgeous. He's reconnected with old friends who he had lost touch with or were no longer speaking to him because he had become such an addict. He's fixing things. He's repairing himself.
You write, though, that by the end of their careers, the big fashion conglomerates, they didn't really need these star designers anymore, that they had their vision, they had used their looks to create their brand, and they could just use kind of less high-maintenance designers to carry on the looks.
Absolutely. My first book, Deluxe, was a look, a study of how globalization changed the way the fashion industry and all, you know, many industries changed in the 1990s and the early 2000s, that many businesses went from small privately held companies that did, you know, $50, $100 million a year in sales or business into global publicly traded conglomerates doing billions of dollars a year in sales, and the effects of that on the businesses. But what I did not write about in Deluxe that I've addressed in Gods and Kings was the effect on the creative side of the businesses. And I think that this is a case in businesses, creative businesses across the board, in theater, in cinema, in music, in literature, in art. As the companies have gotten so big, they needed the designers, they needed these marquee names to take them global, to make noise, to make headlines, to dress women on the red carpets, to do ribbon cuttings, to be the faces of the companies and spokesmen for the companies. But once the companies became so global and strong, they didn't need those spokesmen anymore. The brand became the star. Steve Jobs is gone, but it became about Apple. John Galliano is gone, but it is really about Christian Dior, which is now just simply Dior. You know, the brands are what shine, and that's what translates across the markets, particularly in Asia, which is the biggest booming market mankind has ever seen. And so the star designer is no longer important, and these young kids just go and work pretty much anonymously. If you're in the fashion industry and you sit in the front row of shows, you know, 12 or 18 weeks a year, you know who the designer of Gucci and Saint Laurent and Valentino is, but most consumers don't, and that's because they just want Valentino, Yves Saint Laurent, Gucci, the brands to be on their mind and in their closets.
And the artistic geniuses behind those, they just don't matter anymore. That's so sad to me.
It's just commercial, and it's got us, you know, the demand is so huge now. You know, these businesses do $6 billion a year in sales. When Louis Vuitton, until the late 1970s, early 80s, Louis Vuitton had only two stores. For 100 years, they had two stores, Nice and Paris. Now they're more than 400. And most of the brands are like that. And so to reach all those people, you just got to keep churning out product. You got to have new, fresh product all the time. You have to have teams of people just putting it out. It's about quantity, and it's about mass, and it's about profits.
Dana Thomas, her new book is Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Coming up in the program, we'll find out whom you think should replace Jon Stewart. You can tell us on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. And we'll check in with Warren Olney. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and joining me in the studio, as he does almost every single day at this time, Warren Olney, to give us a preview of what's up at 1 o'clock.
Hello. Always nice to be here. We're going to have a conversation today about oil drilling as opposed to wind development in the Atlantic Ocean, a very interesting situation there with the president's policies seeming to conflict with one another. We'll also hear from Yemen, where Rod Nordland says that even though the U.S. embassy has been shut down and American Marines have had their guns taken away, it's really not as hysterical a situation, to use his word, as is being reported by CNN and others. Very interesting conversation with him.
Okay, that's coming up in about 5 minutes from now. Warren Olney and To the Point. Thank you. And now joining me in the studio, as she does every single day, Jolie Myers with the feedback.
I'm no Warren only, but Warren has better things to do than the feedback, so we can't make him stick around and
He's
give it
to
us.
He's got a whole show to do.
He does. He has a whole show to do. It's idea time, Madeline, and I think we really need to think big. I have an idea that I think could change the face of TV, and I think that we should elect the new host of The Daily Show. That's a horse race that I would completely pay attention to, would make me not want to jump off a building.
Would people lobby? Would there be political
There'd be
action
super
committees?
PACs. There would be all kinds. There'd be a convention. It would be way more fun
would
than
we
presidential
have debates?
Elections. Debates? Sure. Campaign commercials? Delightful. They'd be fantastic. We, of course, wanted to know who you would vote for in the Daily Show election. Many people want to see current Daily Show correspondent Jessica Williams in the chair. Another Williams also got a lot of votes. Brian Williams. Apparently he has some time on his hands now, and a lot of people have the same idea. Samantha Bee is another favorite, longtime Daily Show correspondent. Now, Press Play manager, managing editor Andrew Walsh insists that Pauly Shore is the right choice. I tried to talk to him, but he wouldn't hear of anyone else.
Pauly Shore, is he, where is he now?
He's in Silver Lake. I heard him on the Marc Maron show the other day, so
he's
around.
How about Marc Maron?
I think he's looking for work. Marc Maron, great. Thinking outside the box here, Madeline. This is what we're doing today.
Or outside the garage.
Yeah. Thinking outside the garage, exactly. Mike Gagne says that John Oliver has already proved that he can do the job. Hello, Comedy Central. Hire him. But Molly Thiessen on Facebook says that Comedy Central should just cancel The Daily Show. Jon Stewart is irreplaceable.
Okay, Julie Myers, thank you very much. You're irreplaceable as well.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
If Jon Stewart is looking for something to do, he can do this on every Friday for us. I'll go home early. That's fine.
You can switch places. Julie Myers hosts The Daily Show. Now there's an idea. Okay, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play, if you'd like to say yes to that idea or anything else. We're an all-new To The Point, up next at 1 o'clock. Have a great afternoon, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.